funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today Charles Simich, award-winning poet. His most recent book is Jackdaws. Recent books include A Wedding in Hell, The Book of Gods and Devils. He has books of essays and interviews, a selected and collected poems, translations of Serbian poetry. What I want to say is that at the gate, his work made me love poetry at a time when I had no instinct for it. But there was a poem that came, it was given to me, called Fork, and I'm going to recite it by heart. This strange thing must have crept right out of hell. It resembles the bird's foot worn around the cannibal's neck. As you hold it in your hand, as you stab with it into a piece of meat, it is possible to imagine the rest of the bird, its head, which, like your fist, is large, bald, beakless, and blind.
Excellent.
I was so thrilled that next they were able to give me this living hand, that Keats poem, and it does sort of the same thing with, you know, a hand becoming an object, blood flowing between the two. It was such a relief because up until that point, poetry seemed to me one of those, you know, scary, arid things that cultural people liked and that I didn't know how to climb onto. And you've spoken of your work as being peasant-oriented or, you know, coming from nursery rhymes and folk tales and things before speech. I wonder, did you start with the impulse to make poems that could be understood by people who feared poetry?
Of course not. I mean, I started as a follower of Hart Crane, and if you know Hart Crane's poetry, it's beautiful, but it's very hermetic, very difficult to understand. And like anyone, you know, young, starting out, and this was in the 50s, mid-50s, you know, a poem that is incomprehensible, but delightful in some way. I mean, that was sort of my idea, to mystify the reader, not to please the reader. It took a long time, you know, being influenced by many, many poets before I felt, I mean, around the time when I wrote the poem Fork, which was back in 1964, you know, getting tired and saying, well, I should write something accessible in a way that, say, blues music, which I love very much, is accessible, you know, good old blues. I had a feeling that I had to begin again, that I had to, you know, find poetry in the place where I lived. And I lived in a shabby little apartment in Greenwich Village. There was very few objects, really, around me. I only had one knife, one fork, and one spoon. The idea was to see this everyday objects with new eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, gradually, these poems bloomed and became parts of environments that also featured threads, insects, rats, flies in particular, little theaters, in mm-hmm. a sense,
yes,
of in sort of enchanted pedestrian objects that delight in their poverty and frightfulness.
Yes.
I wonder, because eventually these objects enter a kind of repertory company
yes.
in your
yes.
work,
yes.
And you've written a beautiful book published by Echo Press, as the new book, Jack Straws, is published by Harkett Brace, a beautiful book called Dime Store Alchemy about Joseph Cornell, who you acknowledge as one American artist who you are in the tradition of, whom you admire.
Yes.
And he, too, has a repertoire of objects.
Yes. I mean, clearly, you could say I have obsessions that I'm unable to get rid of.
But why do you have, you know, these particular obsessions? Do you know?
Well, I mean, let's, in this, for example, this new book has a lot of insects and bugs. And when I was young, like any kid, if you saw an ant, you step on an ant. If you were bored, you spent a couple hours stepping on ants or killing flies or whatever. But inadvertently, as I grew older, I have become a kind of Buddhist of sorts. Every time I see any little insect or any little critter, anything crawling or flying. And I live in a country, so there are many opportunities to see these things. I'm very interested. I mean, I sort of see them as individuals, no longer as species, and I follow them. I pay attention to them. And I don't want to use big words like reverence for life or but just the notion of this is also an individual of sorts. I mean, I do not believe that even the lowest form of life is not unique. The little singular insect is not unique. And so a kind of fascination with them, with their little small errands, with their complicated maneuvers.
Well, let's hear the one of the I think this is a fly poem from the new collection Jack Straws by my guest Charles Simich.
The soul has many brides. In India, I was greatly taken up with a fly in a temple, which gave me the distinct feeling it was possible, just possible, that we had met before. Was it in Mexico City, climbing the blood-spotted yellow legs of the crucified Christ while his eyes grew larger and larger? May God seat you on the highest throne of his invisible kingdom, a blind beggar said to me in English. He knew what I saw. At the saloon where Pancho Villa fired his revolver at the ceiling, on the bare ass of a naked nymph stepping out of a lake in a painting, and now shamelessly crawling up one of Buddha's nostrils, whose smile got even more secretive, even more squint-eyed.
Charles Simich reading The Soul Has Many Brides from Jack Straws. There's a kind of comedy of mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it being there in Bruno Schultz, for instance, well.
Yes,
where part of comedy is, in a sense, pathos and poverty, that somehow or other these things have been transformed by the comic sense.
Yes, I mean, these are all comic situations. I mean, you know, we talk to the stars as if they understood us. Why not talk to cockroaches as if they understood us? But these situations are comic. I mean, I'm interested, as I said before, in this attempt to reach out to and somehow be acknowledged, which of course there's never a reply from the other. they simply proceed on their errands without heeding us.
Let's hear another poem.
Medieval miniature. Souls burning in hell, how exceedingly modest your eternal torments appear to me in comparison to that of a firebomb city. A couple of awkward-looking devils are sticking long pitchforks in you. Another is down on his knees, reviving the fire by blowing on it. It's enough to make the sinners go ha-ha, when in two whoops and a holler, a whole neighborhood can be incinerated, leaving nothing much to see. A lone dog roaming in the rubble can break the meanest heart. By the looks of it, he's young and curious. We leave him thus, earnestly digging with his paws. The woman licked by flames, in the meantime, has divine breasts. The unknown artist made sure of that.
Charles Simich, reading from his new collection, Jack Straws, published by Harkett Brace. Now, this, of course, brings up the presence of the political in your work, and this poem seems to suggest that anything that the imagination has been able to do in this way, Bosch, for instance, is nothing placed against the physical actuality of destruction. And in a sense, it seems to be reprimand those people who feel that artists should not create scenes of destruction, that they're meant to be, you know, somehow beyond that. But now we're talking about the city, I believe, where you were born, which is in flames, Belgrade. And I wonder how that is able to enter your poetry.
Well, I have written a lot about bombings because I was bombed when I was 3 years old. This is 1941, April 6th. The Nazis were bombing Belgrade, and a bomb hit a building across the street, and I flew out of my bed across the room and woke up. It was 5 in the morning. Then in 1944, we were bombed by the Allies. They're not bombing us, they're bombing the Germans. And missed mostly Germans and hit, you know, slums. I mean, that's how it usually happens. So bombs have been on my mind most of my life, and I have a lot of poems about bombs, inevitably. I mean, what always seems incredible to me about bombing is that, it's based essentially on the idea of collective responsibility, collective guilt, and you decide to fight evil, but then you end up by, you know, doing some evil yourself. Specifically in relationship to this poem, I was looking at some reproductions, some miniatures, medieval miniatures, and of course there are all these sort of scenes of hell, you know, people burning in hell, in this case a beautiful woman, but they're like even children, you know, burning in hell and so forth. And I was struck by how laughable these scenes were to, if you think of Hiroshima, if you think of the firebombing of Dresden, Second World War, they could not imagine anything comparable to the horrors of the 20th century, and the horrors of the 20th century have always been in my mind. I remember when I was a kid, the sound, I mean, of the bombs falling, in, you know, from being in the cellar, it's a terrible sound because you hear a whistle and then it, and this sort of, I can't even find the words for it. A sound sort of in the bowels of the earth, so, you know. But you can't judge. You have no sense of where exactly it has fallen. You feel claustrophobic. You feel, confined.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a matter of fact, I wanted to ask you about that word because as I was reading the Dime Store Alchemy book, I thought one of the words that doesn't get used by you but that is central is confinement.
Confinement.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, I think I even mentioned Bartleby the Scrivener, the sort of retreating into the corner. What I like about Cornell, and I think I've done myself many times, is I sort of like to retreat into a corner. I mean, paint myself into a corner, put myself in impossible situations as a poet, as an artist, as somebody who thinks. You know, reduce everything down to few essential items, few essential objects. And then let's see what you got here. Let's see how you're going to solve the problem of your life, the problem of human existence in the corner of a cellar while bombs are falling in your head.
Well, I was astonished once, I mean, to find that this is actually a school of literature that they called it Das Glück in Winkel, Happiness in a Corner. And apparently it was Schlegel who created this idea that this is a entire field for literature to explore, and therefore would follow books with titles like A Journey Around My Room.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, it's that whole idea that if you know the work of Gaston Bachelard, Poetics of Space, how, you know, the miniature cracks in the wall, water stains on the ceiling, in which one can discover huge space infinities that open up. These are all images of inwardness. I mean, projections of inwardness. I mean, you, to go back to what you were saying earlier, the theater. I mean, this is really an inner theater. I would say for me, the big influence or what gave me this tendency is chess. When I was young, very young, I played very good chess. Started playing chess when I was about, I think, about 6 years old, during the war, Second World War, 1944. So, to my absolute astonishment, I found out I could beat most grown-ups, who, in addition to being miserable about the war, were additionally made miserable to be beaten by a, you know, 6-7-year-old kid at chess. So I think that in some ways, although I really haven't given this much thought to this very minute, that this sort of minimalism, you know, like a chess problem where you have just 3 or 4 figures left, more, you know, half a dozen figures left on the on the board, on the chessboard, and it says something like the white mates, you know, checkmates in 2 moves, or they used to have these things in newspapers, and you set them on the chessboard, and then you spend months looking at this thing and saying it's got to be a mistake here. And then it all falls into place.
Well, what I'm filled with is I've been thinking a lot recently about Lewis Carroll. And, of course, he's a chess master. But it seems as if the concomitant of the love of chess are the insects that appear in the forest that he writes about in Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, mirrors because of the mirrored sides of the chessboard.
Sure.
But that strange fascination with lizards, small animals, and giving things voices. I wonder if chess almost forces that kind of consciousness.
A great chess move is also a great aesthetic move. I mean, there's a beauty to beautifully executed maneuvers that trap your opponent. Kind of a splendid insincerity that triumphs in a work of art. You know, it's total artifice. You set out to deceive, to lie, and then at the end, what emerges is this gloriously concluded game. And if it's really glorious, even your opponent says, you know, admits this is magnificent how you tricked him. And poetry, you know, is constantly making things up. It's constantly lying. is constantly an artifice, but for the sake of this other thing.
But it's also, you remind me that it takes place in a very small space.
In a very small space. Poems are boxes. Poems are chessboards. And you, to go back to the idea, yes, you have your same characters, repertory figures. You have your figures, you have your instincts, you have this, you have that, and you just move them around the chessboard.
Yes, and to some extent, each poem is made of strategies that, in fact, like a chess puzzle that says mate in two, your poems seem to be about getting as much to happen in eight lines.
Right.
So as if you...
Right,
the
right.
moves must
because
be...
Because in some ways, there is seemingly sometimes an infinite number of moves. I mean, not really infinite number of moves, as we know, because we have computers now playing chess. But the possibilities, the endless possibilities of an end game.
I wanted to end by talking a little bit about spirituality and mysticism.
Sure.
And to talk about, to conclude with the final poem in the book. My guest is Charles Simich, and the book is called Jackstraws. But there seems to have been, as the work has progressed, a more and more, I wouldn't say serious, because one doesn't want to call anything serious, it's a stigma, but Meister Eckhart begins to make his appearance more and more in the poems. There's a sense that if not the spiritual life, at least the inventory of books of the spiritual life are of great importance to you, and that there's been more devotion to some other realm, that the poems have in some way, do they, led you there?
Well, it's a, like anything else in life, it's complicated. I was a great reader of mystic literatures of, you know, East and West, early on, I mean, in my, you know, early 20s, I started reading Meister Eckhart and all of that. Evelyn Underhill's book, Mysticism, I read that, I think I may have been like 21. So this has always been on my mind, and I have reread these various works. You know, progressively, as you think about these things, I mean, I began to realize that in some ways I live in a paradox. On one hand, I have deep mystical feelings or intuitions about a transcendental, I don't want to say reality, but something beyond the beyond appearances. At the same time, I really don't believe in God in any conventional sense. Mm-hmm. So this is like, you know, a person who is incredibly superstitious. I know people like that who are incredibly superstitious, but they don't believe in God. They think somebody is orchestrating their life. There is fate, but there's no God. So there's a wonderful metaphysical absurdity in this. Again, it's a kind of a comic situation. I mean, in a comic situation. And so these poems are attempts to probe and to, you know, to sort of deal with this and you know, ponder the ramifications of living in this contradiction.
Well, the final poem in Jackstraws is called Mystic Life by my guest, Charles Simich.
Mystic Life. It has an epigraph by my friend Charles Wright, and he has a line from one of his poems, Lifetime's Solitary Tread. It's like fishing in the dark, if you ask me. Our thoughts are the hooks, our hearts the raw bait. We cast a line over our heads, past all believing, into the starless midnight sky, until it's lost to sight. The lines long unraveling, rising in our throats like a sigh of a long day's weariness, soul-searching and reverie. One little thought against the supreme unthinkable. How about that? Mr. Looney Tunes fishing in the dark out of an empty sleeve with a mourning band on it. The fly and the spider on the ceiling looking on, brother. In the highest school of hide and seek, in its vast classroom of smoke and mirrors, where we are the twin dunces left standing in the darkest corner, our fates in the silence of a mouth of the one who had no image, glistening there as if moistened by his tongue. It takes a tiny nibble from time to time, don't you believe it? It sends a shiver down our spines in response, like hell it does. There is a door you've never noticed before left ajar in your room. Don't kid yourself. The song said, "Do nothing till you hear from me." Yes, of course. In the meantime, wear mirror-tinted glasses to bed. Say in your prayers, "In that thou hast sought me, thou hast already found me." That's what the leaves are all upset about tonight. Solitary fishermen lining up like zeros to infinity, lying in the shade, chewing on the bitter verb to be, the ripple of the abyss closing in on them. Therein the mystery and the pity. The hook left dangling in the great nothing, surely sniffed off by X's own mustache-trimming scissors. Nevertheless, aloft, white shirt tails and all, I'll be damned.
Charles Simich, reading Mystic Life from his collection Jack Straws. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Standing in for her today is Alan Howard, who also has given special production assistance. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek, development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.